So, friends, that's the way the Buddha often started his talks when he was talking to the community of monastics. And I think he meant it because he didn't use that word when he didn't use the word all the time anyway, but he didn't use it when he was talking to lay people, to kings or generals or merchants or farmers. He used it when he was talking to the community of his followers. So, and I like the idea. You know, I thought at first, well, you know, when I first heard of this, I thought, well, maybe it's just sort of a boilerplate honorific, like writing to whom it might concern at the beginning of a business letter. But no, I think for the reasons I just gave, that he actually meant it. He regarded the monastic community as his friends. So I'm talking, of course, about the Sangha. And we earlier took the three refuges. I take refuge in Buddhang Saranang Gacchami, Dhammang Saranang Gacchami, Sangham Saranang Gacchami. And the third one of those, well, it's I take refuge in the Buddha, I take refuge in the Dharma, in his teachings, and I take refuge in the Sangha, in the community of the Buddha's followers. So that's the third refuge that we took. And of course, we took it three times because everything's much nicer if you do it three times. So, how important was the Sangha? So here's a reading from the Samyutta Nikaya. And there are a number of similar readings. So I'm just going to pick, I picked one almost at random. Actually, it's the first one that came up in a Google search. So this is from 45.2 in the Samyutta Nikaya. I have heard, and by that I have heard, that's Ananda speaking, by the way. It's a reformulation of thus have I heard. So we can be grateful to Ananda for remembering all of these discourses. I have heard that on one occasion the Blessed One was living among the Sakyans. Now there is a Sakyan town named Sakara. Their venerable Ananda went to the Blessed One, and on arrival, having bowed down to the Blessed One, sat to one side. As he was sitting there, venerable Ananda said to the Blessed One, "This is half the holy life, Lord, admirable friendship, admirable companionship, admirable camaraderie." The Buddha said, "Don't say that, Ananda. Don't say that. Admirable friendship, admirable companionship, admirable camaraderie is actually the whole of the holy life. When a monk or a nun has admirable people and as friends, companions, and comrades, he can be expected to develop and pursue the Noble Eightfold Path." Now, of course, he's talking about the monastic community, but what he's saying is still applicable to us. You've probably all figured out by now that it's really hard to practice on your own. It's really hard to practice without the support of friends, of friendship. Now, the Western Sangha is quite novel, and the Buddha was talking about the community of monks and nuns, the monastic community, when he talked about Sangha. And for many centuries, that's exactly what people meant when they talked about Sangha, when they talked about community. But it's come to mean something more broader in recent times. The Western Sangha includes both lay and monastic people. And this is a relatively recent development. The idea that lay people could even practice meditation is a relatively novel one. It's a 20th century idea, and to the best of my knowledge, the first one who had this idea was Mahasi Sayadaw. Sayadaw is the honorific. Mahasi was his actual name, sort of like saying the Right Reverend Mahasi. And he had the idea that you could actually open the monastery for 10 days, let lay people come in, spend 10 days living like a monastic, and you would teach them stuff about meditation and about the Buddhism, and then send them off again. And this turned out to be a very popular idea. It was taken up by others in the Thai forest tradition in Thailand. And you've probably heard about Goenka, who opened up centers that followed this model of 10-day retreats throughout India and much of the Western world. And there are people in Sangha tonight who've been to Goenka retreats. I don't know if I'd recommend it. I do know people who really liked them and other people who really hated them. It's very much like boot camp. It's very austere. And part of it is that the tradition came out of the idea of having people go off and join a monastery for 10 days. That's why when you go to a residential retreat at Spirit Rock, they wake you up at 5 a.m. There's no logic to it. It's just that they decided to maintain that tradition of acting as if you're going to the monastery for 10 days or 5 days or however long it's going to be. The old model, previous to this, opening the doors to lay people, was more along the lines of what lay people could hope for was a better lifetime, a better rebirth. So if they behaved themselves and did all the right things, they could hope for a better rebirth. And maybe in the next lifetime or the time after that, they could become a monastic and aspire to enlightenment, aspire to liberation. And it doesn't really entirely fit in with the Buddha's teachings. The Buddha did, on a number of occasions, talk to lay people who became immediately enlightened on talking to the Buddha. Now, it turns out that these people who became lay people who became instantly enlightened either immediately joined the monastic order and became one part of the monastic community, or they died, like were gored by a cow or something. I won't go into the story here, but those of us who know about advice to Bahia, but that's a different talk. So the biggest Buddhist organization in North America is called the Buddhist Church of America. And it is entirely made up of Asian immigrants, or, you know, generations of descendants of Asian immigrants. And it's very much modeled after American churches in its organizational structure. And part of that was they didn't want to frighten people in the local communities, making them think they were trying to import some kind of exotic, wacky Eastern religion. They wanted to just let people know that they were practicing a religion just like us Catholics and Presbyterians and Jews were. But they have that same model, and they come from a tradition, Mahayana, one of the principal Mahayana traditions of you follow that hope for a better rebirth. And for now, you light incense at the appropriate times and you live an ethical life and you hope that things get better in the next lifetime. Now, what's interesting is that people in this tradition are just starting to rediscover meditation practices and are doing that. So it's going to be very interesting seeing how that pans out over the next decade or two. So how do we deal with creating Sangha? We don't have a deep tradition in Buddhism the way we do Judaism or Christianity. I'm going to touch on this some more in a little while. But I want to observe something about community that's probably obvious to everyone, and that is that you don't join a community, you create it. So some years ago, this is maybe 8 or 10 years ago, I was at our church. Barbara and I attend church. And as I'll explain, it's not so much that we particularly like the metaphysics of it the belief system. We've really liked the sense of community, and we've formed some very deep friendships through that group. But we were at a social gathering at that, you know, sort of after a service, you know, the cookies and the coffee in the meeting room. And an old friend named Norman was there with two of his friends. And they were having cookies and coffee, and they were sort of talking to each other and looking around the room. And I went over and said, "Oh, hi, Norman, how are you?" And he introduced me to his friends. And about 3 or 4 months later, Norman and his two friends showed up at Marin Sangha. And I think it was at our current meeting place, or our pre-COVID meeting place, St. Mark's Church. And it was the same three friends, and he, they were looking around a little nervously. So I asked him, "Well, you guys were at the church a couple months ago, and here you are at Marin Sangha. What brings you to these places?" And Norman said, "Well, we're looking for a community. You know, we're looking for a place that has a sense of community." And then Norman and his friends didn't come back. So I think what Norman and his friends didn't realize that you don't just show up and expect everyone to flock around you saying, "Oh, here's some community." You know, it's sort of like, yeah, you get to eat the cookies and drink the coffee, but that's really not what it's all about. I can't help but think of one of the reasons, I think the main reason that we were going to that church was that the senior minister at that time had been Barbara's roommate in grad school. So she had disappeared from our lives for about 10 years and then came back as senior minister of this church, the really big church in Berkeley. So we went there and we liked her talks and we liked the music a lot. One of the things that Pat did, her name was Pat DeYoung. One of the things that Pat did was that if you showed up more than once or twice to that church, she would try to recruit you onto a committee or onto some other function so that you were actually engaged in doing something in the church. Because she knew that people would drift in and out if she did not get them involved somehow in the church. It was a great strategy because people would start to get involved. And once they had some skin in the game, they would stay, they'd be part of the community, they'd contribute to the community and help build the community. So I want to say a few things about Marin Sangha. Marin Sangha was started in summer of 1998. And I think it was July of 1998. I just vaguely remember hearing that somewhere. And Philip was there, obviously, Philip Moffat. And Art was there. Vita, were you there? Vita was there. I'm not, anyone else from this group tonight were there? I don't think so. And you folks might remember Doug and Brooke and Denise. And they're no longer attending Sangha. They've moved on to other places. Barbara and I joined in May of 2000, almost by accident. We had gone to a retreat taught by Philip Moffat, a 5-day, and we just picked that retreat out of a hat. We had been to a couple of 3-day retreats, and we had the courage, and it took some courage, to go to a 5-day retreat, which seems pretty tame now. But we just chose one, looked like an interesting thing, mindfulness of the body. Philip was one of the teachers, and we really liked his style. And Barbara said, "Oh, well, we should go to his Sunday night Sangha." And I thought, "Oh, come on. I don't want to give up my Sunday night." So I thought we'd go to a couple. I would just humor Barbara. And then we'd, you know, move away from it and get our Sunday nights back. So here we are still doing it. And we're on the board of directors. So that's how we got involved. We still sort of feel like the new people sometimes. And one of the things that happened to us early on was we were driving back to Berkeley and getting back to Berkeley, looking for a place to have dinner at like 9 o'clock was when we hit Berkeley. Not too many places open in Berkeley on a Sunday night at 9 o'clock. So we went to a couple, and it was kind of dreary eating that late. I didn't want to go home and cook and eat something at 9:30. So one night I went to Brooke and said, you know, we're thinking we ought to try and, you know, and I explained our dilemma and said, we were thinking of you know, having dinner over here somewhere in San Rafael and invite people from the Sangha to join us. And Brooke thought for a minute and she said, okay, I'll join you. And so we said, well, where will we go? And I don't even remember where we went, but the three of us went out to dinner. And that turned into an ongoing, long-term dinner group. So we sort of, without realizing it, had created our own committee. Pat would be very proud of us, I'm sure. So that was one of the ways in which a sense of community developed within the larger community. And then, of course, Philip left and we had, backed off from being the administrator and the principal teacher of Marin Sangha. And we had a decision of what to do because we'd been very teacher-oriented. People joined the Sangha because they liked Philip's teachings. That's what brought us in. So what were we going to do? We could just shut our doors and go away from it, but we didn't. We thought, here's an opportunity to become we were already quite Sangha focused, but we could really buy into that completely because we no longer had a principal teacher. We had to suddenly start bringing in teachers ourselves and creating or continuing to create and maintain the Sangha. This was like back in 2013, I believe. So we've managed, which is really quite surprising. We've run into all kinds of problems we did not foresee. We've managed to avoid problems that we worried about quite a lot, really obsessed about, did not turn out to be issues. So I want to talk about some of the people in Sangha. First of all, there are, I feel in some ways I'm doing a duplicate here because at the end of the year, we're going to be doing an evening of remembrance. We've been doing this for many years now recollection of the past year and setting our attentions for the future year. And when we do that, we don't bring in a teacher. And one of us guides the meditation. In fact, Barbara's done it for a couple of years going. And it's turned into a really sweet ritual that I really look forward to. And I hope you'll all join us for that. And so some of the stuff that I'm going over is stuff that we would probably touch on that night. We do it close to New Year's Eve, on the Sunday closest to New Year's Eve, usually. So the people that have come and gone. There are several people who have died who were members of our community. John Levy, who joined us as a friend, he was a close friend of Phillips. He always sat in the front row in a chair back at Turtle Island. For those of you who remember him, he looking like an Old Testament patriarch with his white beard and white hair. There's John Hess, an awfully sweet person who had Parkinson's. Many of you may remember Rachmel Ben Avram, who also came not so much recently, but came often to Turtle Island and somewhat later. And then and one of the things that we have not yet established is, you know, we haven't really gotten into some of the community observances like funerals. Of course, we didn't really know about some of these departures until it was too late to organize something, or we went to a funeral or hoped to go to a funeral that was already organized. We also had some troubled people in the Sangha. There was a woman who carpooled with us a number of times, and then I figured out pretty quickly that we were picking her up at a halfway house. And found out from her that she couldn't drive because her license had been suspended because of a DUI. And it was clear that she had substance problems, but she's a very sweet person. She once brought a very noisy puppy to Sangha. And so we had Philip trying to talk, where there was all this yipping and whining going on from the back of the room. But I miss her. She showed up many years later with a new boyfriend, and it was really great to see that she had stabilized her life. And then I'm sorry that we don't see her anymore. There was a woman who could be quite difficult, who is now in a facility. And I don't know if we could call him a member of the Sangha, but there was a guy who came to Sangha a couple of times. And then about 5 or 6 years ago, he actually stole the wallet out of the coat of somebody who was new to the Sangha, had never come to Sangha before, hung up his coat on a coat rack. And this guy stole it. And first I thought, oh my God, the new guy's trying to scam us. But it turns out that the guy who stole it was caught on camera trying to use the victim's credit card at the local hardware store. So I guess this is a long way of pointing out that the nature of Sangha means that we have to deal with a lot of different people, people that we like, people that we find difficult. And there's going to be some more on this later. The woman who is now in a facility, at one time, she used to come to Spirit Rock retreats. And at one time, she came to a retreat, even though she had behaved badly at some previous retreats and was on the list of, nope, we're not going to let her do it anymore. And then Philip decided to let her join the retreat. And he came and talked to a number of us to make sure to try to settle us down. And he pointed out, she's a member of the Sangha. And what Sangha is it's about dealing with people that sometimes you would rather not deal with. And that's been a practice. And some more practices that we have done through Marin Sangha that have been really, I think, helpful are well, Dharma partners, people getting together, pairs of people getting together and supporting each other in the Dharma, in their practice. One of the stories I love, and I tell this often, I've told this often when, you know, Barbara and I teach the Back to Basics introductory course, is someone who calls up her friend like once a week and they agree to meditate. And so they the friend hangs. This is you, Vita, isn't it? It is. She's laughing, right? Vita, I forget who she's calling, but she calls up.
Sarah.
It's all right. Vita calls Sarah.
Or they Sarah say, calls Vita.
Right. And we'll meditate for half an hour. They hang up. And then half an hour later, one calls the other and says, and they talk about the meditation, how they were doing. So the fact that even though they're alone, the fact that they've rung each other up on the phone means that they're actually meditating together. I love that. We also have a number of study groups. Some of them have gone on for quite some time. A group of us have a Sutta study group that meets once a month. And I know that there's at least one other, maybe two. There's also a lot of friendships. Barbara and I have formed a lot of close friendships through this Sangha. We've done some road trips. We took a road trip with Art up to visit a retreat that Pa Ok was holding up at, I think, Clear Lake. And it was wonderful. I had a brief audience with Pa Ok, who told me I was doing it all wrong. I sat one of those grueling two-hour sits at Pa Ok's retreat, and I at least had the pleasure of opening my eyes occasionally and seeing that the Burmese monk, who was the sit leader sitting up front, had a bad case of Vipassana whiplash. If anybody doesn't know what Vipassana whiplash is, it's when you start to fall asleep and you snap your neck up and then you nod out again. And then Vita and us went up to a Bayagiri monastery once. That was another great one. So we've formed a lot of close friendships. And then various projects. We've done Clean Up the Bay project together. I know that Patty has done projects to provide school supplies for kids who need them. And then, of course, the practice I mentioned earlier, the year-end recollection of the past year and of the setting of intentions for the coming year. And of course, we have the practice right now, when we'd rather not have, of COVID. Here we are, looking like Hollywood Squares, or the titles to the Brady Bunch, and not being able to have hugs, not being able to get together. It's better than nothing, but it's very interesting. It's been very interesting watching how that works as a mechanism for trying to sustain community. And what's interesting, part of what's interesting, of course, is that in some ways the community is broadened. I don't see them here tonight, but we've had people, we've had a guy coming in from Albuquerque. We've had a couple that have been taking care of campsites in California. And what they did for a number of weeks was they drove to the nearest public library so they could pick up some Wi-Fi signal in their car. So we'd actually see them sitting in their car in Sangha. And we would not be able to do that if we were only meeting in person. So, of course, we're trying to figure out, can we get together in person, because we really want to do that, and still have a way of having people come in and join us remotely? So we're still thinking on that one. But back to Sangha in general, what it really does is it invites comparison with Judaism and Christianity in the West. Because, of course, here we are without a strong tradition of Buddhism in the West. It's a relatively recent import. But our parents and our ancestors, many of them went to church or synagogue. Buddhism in the West is an intentional community, for good or ill. It's not accidental. We weren't born into it. We weren't dragged to Buddhist wats when we were little kids, yawning and being impatient and wondering what the hell was going on. We chose to be here. And that's both a strength and a weakness. We don't have the roots. We don't have the tradition behind us. The church that Barbara and I go to are more about community than a belief system, which is unusual, I think, in the U.S. We actually have a friend who identifies in that church, who identifies herself as a Christian atheist. And I think a number of people in that church are quite sympathetic with that. But they're still very interested in spiritual growth and in the social justice philosophy of the church, and of course about the community. And in Buddhism, of course, we tend to be less about community and more about meditation and the Buddhist teachings, the Bodhidharma. So part of what happens in Sangha is we get people who are broken, people who are looking for healing. Whereas the church, the people are there by tradition, and most of them aren't there because they're looking for something to repair them. They're not looking for a healing, particularly. Some of them are, or they hope for a healing, but they're there because their parents were there. There's a big tradition of people who grow up in the church, become young adults, and in their 20s, they leave the church. They don't care about it. It's old stuff. Then they get married. They settle down. They have kids, and they want their kids to grow up in the church because they want to have their kids enjoy the structure that they had when they were kids. And so you get a lot of these families returning to the church, not because of any belief system, but because of the societal structure around it. They're there by tradition. One of the things that we've talked about before about community is we spent a little time with, had a dinner with two members of this church. And one of them talked about what she called the 2 a.m. test. She said that she felt that she could call anybody in the church at 2 a.m. if she had a problem or an emergency, and that they wouldn't hang up on her, that they would spend time with her and try to figure out how to help. And I like to think that with this Sangha, with many of the people in the Sangha, yes, there is a 2 a.m. pass test, that they would pass it. I don't know if that's true of everyone, but I don't think I would have said that 10 years ago. And I think I would say that now, that we really do, we really can pass the 2 a.m. test. When you think about it, when you look at the faces there, a great many of them are people who would answer the phone at 2 a.m. and be willing to help. Now, the thing about both communities, and I say both communities, I'm talking about Western Buddhism and I'm talking about the Western liberal churches, progressive churches, and synagogues as the other of the two communities. And both communities, I think, are fragile, and fragile for different reasons. Buddhism, I think, is fragile because you can leave as easily as you join. It's not deeply held. It's, for many of us, fairly recently acquired practice. And we know many people who've joined Sangha, stayed for a couple of years, and then drifted off to other practices, other belief, you know, other belief systems, even though I like to think that we aren't one, or other interests. I think some people have looked at Western Buddhism as a way to meet people of potential romantic interest. Okay, I've seen that some people would be on Do Not Disturb at 2 a.m., but that person would be happy to hear from people after 8 a.m. So I'm not encouraging everybody just to run the 2 a.m. test for the hell of them, okay? That's not the point here. The point is that there's a community that we can lean on, that we can look to for help. So as I said, both communities are fragile for different reasons. And I mentioned that Buddhism, you can leave as easily as you joined. And Christianity and Judaism, I think more so with Christianity, the world is moving away from this kind of institution, at least from the progressive Protestant model. And there are various reasons for that. I'm not going to go into details. I think Judaism is going to stay stronger because it really... even the very conservative Judaic communities are very community oriented, much more so than a lot of churches are. And of course, we have the new challenge of COVID. So, another reading from the Buddha. This is from the Anguttara Nikaya. Section 11.12. I don't know the name of it, and it's just an excerpt. At any time when a disciple of the Noble Ones is recollecting the Sangha, his mind is not overcome with passion, not overcome with aversion, not overcome with delusion. His mind heads straight based on the Sangha. And when the mind is headed straight, the disciple of the Noble Ones gains a sense of the goal, gains a sense of the Dhamma, gains joy connected with the Dhamma. In one who is joyful, rapture arises. In one who is rapturous, the body grows calm. One whose body is calmed experiences ease. In one at ease, the mind becomes concentrated. So I like that. I mean, of course, that's just one of the nice things about Sangha, about community. But I really like the argument here, or the statement, the assertion that when you're with Sangha, you're not overcome with greed, hatred, and delusion. You get little tastes of it. You know, I've had aversion, delusion, greed. Social Sundays and people brought those great cookies. Ooh, greed. So that's really what I wanted to say. So let's just pause for a few moments. Anytime when a disciple of the Noble Ones is recollecting the Sangha, his mind heads straight. So I know I missed, you know, that this sort of came out. I thought about giving a sort of a report on our recent retreat, but it was still too new. And Barbara and I had been talking in the car about Sangha, about community. And Barbara said, you should give a talk about Sangha. I said, oh, no, not another talk about Sangha. Philip used to do those every year or two, and it kind of got old. But we haven't heard one for a long time, so I said, all right, I'll do a talk on Sangha. So I know I missed some of the clever things I thought of saying in the car with Barbara. So please, if we have any additions or comments or questions, please just unmute yourself. If it starts getting crazy, we can go to the hand raising. Okay, Mary.
Thank you, Bill. I guess it was in 1999, my friend Linda was invited to go to the Sangha by another person who hasn't come back, who was a therapist. I think she knew Denise. And I generally don't do this, but I invited myself along. I've been meditating on and off since probably 1970. Different people. And I really was looking for Sangha. And I ended up showing up with Linda at Turtle Island with Philip there. And you know, it's different because you sit silently. You know, you're sitting there, you're not talking to anyone. You're just, you know, walking in and it's quiet. But I was used to that. And what I really like is and one of the things that Philip is really good at is I like the energy. The energy of a Sangha, of people practicing, is palpable. And you can sit there, and we are all there because we want to practice. And just being with like-minded people who are focused and trying to be concentrated, for me, that just it keeps the thoughts at bay. And like you said, the greed, aversion, delusion, it keeps that at bay. And it was just such a lovely experience. And I just thought it was like a homecoming for me. I mean, I can't tell you. It was like I was just, here I am. This, and then the how he talked and what the practice was like. This was just like, you know, this is what I had been looking for decades. So I was just so, so pleased. And I think for me, the community is very, very important. My Dharma friends are really important. It's like reading a Dharma book with somebody and having somebody to talk to about the difference between what my relative life experience is and the ultimate life experience and how I'm trying to find a way to walk between those two. And that's what your Dharma friends are for. They really help. So Sangha is just it's a beautiful, beautiful thing. And I like the fact that we don't join it. We create it. And that's just what we've all been doing. And so I thank all of you who show up, who are here.
As Mary pointed out, I think something that a number of people have discovered is that meditating in a group just has a very different energetic feel than meditating alone. Barbara and I lead a group that meets twice a month at this church in Berkeley, and it's a small group. It's six or eight of us. And those people have all noticed this as well, that meditating together in Zoom is better than meditating alone. It's not as good. It doesn't have the same kind of energetic feel as meditating together in a group. One of the things that I've always noticed at residential retreats is even though everyone is completely silent and not even making eye contact, there's this real sense of companionship. In fact, there's more of a sense of companionship because there's not all this sort of subtext going on. You know, what did they mean by that? What did it's just you're there with a bunch of other people in a room, not trying without any hidden agenda. So it's very sweet to be in a group that's sitting. Someone else? Barbara?
I just wanted to add a little bit to what Mary said too about what I love about Sangha. One of the things is that there are a group of people who would speak the same language. You know, you can talk about the hindrances. You can talk about, you know, sits and practices and greed, hatred, and delusion and what that means. And I find that really helpful in a world where people are going, huh, what's that all about? You know, and you really would be isolated otherwise. So I urge people for that reason to join a Sangha.
That's a good point. Here's a group of people who do not flee in terror when they hear the phrase dependent origination. As I've said, you don't want to say that phrase in front of your aunts or uncles or cousins because they will try to have you locked up or sent to a deprogrammer. But the people in this room understand what that means. I hope, by the way, are there new people tonight? I forgot to welcome new people, and there are a couple of unfamiliar names. Of course, not everybody has their video on. Anyway, if you are new, we're glad to have you. Corey.
Bill, thank you for that. That was really, really sweet. I really appreciated that. And just thinking back and, you know, I think also about the circle of caring that we had, which was this really intentional effort of ours when Philip was still here to create more community. And he really encouraged us to. And then I really liked what you said about, you know, after Philip, and I think that maybe we did create more of a community after Philip because we weren't reliant on one person, one teacher, and his operation to kind of make things happen. So I appreciated that too. And then all Sangha meetings, and when we would have food annually as well, that was always really nice. I think people really look forward to that, and I always did too. And some people would come to that and maybe hadn't come for quite a while. And then I think about some of the people that, you know, we lost on Zoom too, sadly, and aren't seeing some people that we would see in person. And then losing Shahara as well, who would come twice a year, and missing Shahara. And then, you know, you mentioned that we were talking about how to go back in person and we were delivering on that, and then Delta variant. And it just threw a monkey wrench into all of it. I'm wondering if it would be okay if I asked just a show of hands, if we were to go back one Sunday night soon, how many people would be willing to come in person at this point? Would people be willing to let us know? So how many? Hold your hands up. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Looks like 9 or 10. Okay. That's good to know. Oh, and a virtual hand. Great. That's good to know. It gives us, because our next board meeting is next week, and we can plan to do that maybe.
Oh, and you know, I'm glad you brought this up. There are other things that we've done together socially as well. We used to organize picnics, group picnics. There's some old photographs of them somewhere. I should post them on our groups.io page if I can dig them up. And we would have yearly year-end parties, and we haven't done that. We didn't do that last year, obviously. But we have had holiday gatherings. So there have been a number of ways that we've been able to express just being a group. Katie.
I just wanted to mention that one way that I always really experienced a lot of community was in the, I never did set up, but in the taking down. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of just taken for granted friendships that happened then. It was very special to me.